elusive.
I think that's really true. And maybe the other word that comes in useful there is this sense of trace. I think there's quite a lot of my poems that talk about traces of things. And I think, you know, the way, I think there's another poem where I talk about the shape in the grass when someone's got up and they've left a little sort of imprint. So those ideas also, it's sort of a nothingness and a presence. It's presence and absence together.
Yeah.
So I do think that those sort of traces of the absent and that poetry is a sort of a trace maybe of the absent trying to write itself into presence or the present slipping into absence. I think there's a real interplay there. And I know, like what you just said, I think it's T.S. Eliot has a quote, something like, I'll probably say it incorrectly, a poem signifies before it is understood.
Mm.
It's something like that anyway. Mm. It's sort of what you're saying, which is there's some way that we can often understand without even quite knowing. So we've almost grasped it between the lines, so to speak. Mm. And I think a lot of my poems are that. They can seem quite plain speaking on the surface. It's one of the things that I try and do in my poetry is use pretty straightforward language, pretty straightforward circumstances and occasions, but the poem is sort of hidden in there a little bit of what's really going on. So maybe that's getting at what you were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd just like to bring it back to visual art for a moment. Mm. So you've written poems based on art, and you've also engaged in what you call reverse ekphrasis.
Mm.
I was just wondering if you could talk about the process of turning art into poetry and vice versa.
Mm. I might have to stand up to my images again. Is that okay?
Please do.
Brilliant. Yep. What would I show at this point? Okay, well, how about I just give you a little indication. So sometimes what I do are a lot of collaborations with visual artists. So usually a visual artist will say, I'd love to work with a poet. Can we think of something? Often it's one, very strictly one way or the other. So they make something, or a gallery asks me to come in, the portrait gallery, and I'll write in response to their work. Photographer, for instance, Ian North, he did these lovely Canberra series of photographs. They were in the Canberra Museum and Gallery. I'll go in, write some poems based on them. I've worked out pretty quickly that you need, and maybe it goes back a bit to what we were just talking about, you need a lot of space around a poem if it's going to join. I can imagine if I was better at chemistry, there'd be some chemical way of saying if you want your molecules to join, they can't already be sort of complete. Does that make sense? I'm not a chemist. But, you know, that idea that I couldn't make them a perfectly complete, self-contained poem, they wouldn't join with the image. They almost had to be a bit looser and a bit smaller. They had to not be the grand... I couldn't do Speaking Bluntly, the poem I just read, and have it join with somebody else's work. It's saying too much. It's like my little treatise, that one. Whereas I did notice that to do a good collaboration with someone, you need to have given space for their work. They need to have left space for your work. So you go a bit smaller. Smaller sounds somehow negative. I don't mean smaller in a negative way. Maybe I mean more air around it, more space around it, so that those little there's more room for it to join in some molecular way, that it can hook on. It's got some hooks. It's a bit free-floating. It's not totally grounded. It's not, here is the definitive thing that I want my poem to say, signed, sealed and delivered, full stop, end of story. It has to sit loosely. So then there are other ones like this one, which is a collaboration, that was much more back and forward. So this is a fabulous artist, Patsy Healy. She's a ceramic artist. These were shown at Craft ACT in Canberra. Why I got them in there is because it's a good example where sometimes the difficult thing, which you probably all, if you're all creative beings, have come across, where you stumble across something and it's a stumbling block, and you think, oh no, I can't do it. But it ends up being what makes the thing work. So with this, the lovely Patsy Healy, here are some of the examples, a bit nicer images that she's taken, her hand-painted ceramic works, etc., etc. Now she said, oh, let's do a poem on these nine ceramic vessels. It's a great, lovely idea. Then, of course, you think, hold on, nine across nine ceramic vessels. Am I exactly going to, unless I'm going to write number one, number two, number three, or are they going to be on a shelf, start here, read in this direction, have them always facing the right? And you suddenly think, that's not really how a vessel works. As you can see, you know, with these things, so someone's going to go and pick up one or pick up the other, they'll read them in a different order, and at first they think, oh, I can't do it. That's not going to work. we're going to need one huge vessel that I can write one huge poem onto in this monolithic way. Until then, we thought the very idea that she had wanted with this collaboration was to title the piece On the Mountain. We both lived near Mount Majura at the back of our house. It was meant to be about going for walks on this beautiful mountain. And we thought, okay, how do we capture this idea of going for walks in different directions? So I sort of hit on the idea, I'll write a poem where each stanza is about the different places that you can go on your mountain walk. And the fact that you might go this way this time and this way that time, you might head up to the summit first and then down to the Billabong next and then through the little foresty part and then out onto the broad road. It's a bit like Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken, you know, this idea of the two roads diverged in a wood. So it's really capturing the process of walking. And as soon as we hit on that, you realise, oh, the concept, the material, the media, the poem, all work together. So the very thing that I thought, oh no, actually ended up generating that lovely interplay of when the concept, the form, the poem all come together nicely. So then there are other things. Let me just escape from this so that I can show you so I don't have to go through all of those ones. So these are all, those are just my artwork. Collaborations, okay, with people like Patsy Payne. She's a printmaker, and we made a lovely artist book. It's a limited edition artist book with little haikus of mine and her prints on it. Then I've written some poems in response to a glass artist at the Canberra Glass Works. So she made these beautiful glass hearts filled with neon gases that when you touch them, they would glow and respond to your hand, just absolutely beautiful. And so I wrote a sort of a poetic exhibition catalogue review, part philosophy, part poem, in response to, so as you can see, there's little quotes in there, but it's also a long poem in response to those beautiful glass works. I won't read them to you. And then also with a neon glass artist, for a couple of different festivals. She made neon in response to some of my works. And this one is also quite interesting because this is Karen Florence. She's a bookmaker and she took my notebook. She makes art based on process. So she took all of my notebooks for writing one poem called Vitreous Cineresis. And she used all of the notes and went back and made a sort of a video about the process of editing that I'd gone through to write, which was really interesting for me because I thought when she said this, she said, can I have your notebooks? I said, sure. And I'm thinking, you're not going to find much really interesting in there. I thought I was pretty, write it pretty straightforwardly. She showed it at a gallery. So all of these were prints of different stages from my books. And in the middle is an iPad. Hold on, this is something close up. I'll just play you a tiny bit whilst I'm talking, so you'll see what I mean then. So what she did was she took all of the notebooks and showed how much editing I had done. I had no idea. It was actually really interesting. So all of those scribble is mine. I always write. I don't write onto a computer. And so she's made this sort of PowerPoint, I don't know what's that called, a sort of a video. And anything once it comes into bold and normal font is what remains in the poem. And all the rest sort of shows, all the italics show everything that gets cut, everything that gets changed over time. And so she's sort of made this interesting thing that sort of really shows the process. You'll get a little sense of it. I'll just let 30 seconds more or something go so you get an idea of all the changes that would happen. And I found that a really interesting collaboration because then you learn something about your own process after seeing what she's actually made from that and how it's changed. I do lots of arrows to different words and crossings out and changing things. So it was actually quite interesting. And that you see all the things, like all of that's gone. You know, and you realise that your poem starts off much bigger and then really gets cut back. So, yeah, brilliant. I'll just stop that one now. And maybe the last one that I might just show you in response to your question about these collaborations was I'd had a composer, I sing in a choir, and I had a composer ask if he could use one of my poems to write a piece, a composition. And so this poem, Unspoken, we actually performed as a choir. I'll just play you the first few minutes just so that you can hear a little bit. I mean, it's a community, it's a decent community choir. But just so you have a sense of it. And again, what was lovely about that, that I might just tell you, is like with the collaboration with Carmen Florence, this was again something where I really learned something from it. So it's quite a short little poem, quite a straightforward little poem. And then when you hear what someone else has done with it, you think, I hear it back and I think it's completely captured the spirit of how I meant it. You think, how did that happen? It's this long, in a 6-minute choral piece. And so that was really lovely, and you hear the tone come back to you in this transformed way, but also a reinforcing way. It was really fun. But it was a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed that part of it as well.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, you said that you adapt your own poetry to an artwork and back again to a poem. But what was it like to have another artist, a composer, take your poem and turn it into their art?
Yeah, it was really interesting, and it's something I'd like to do a lot more of. In fact, one of the projects that I'm really hoping to do in the next year or so, because I know quite a few composers, and they often do use poetry, and it's a bit like what I was saying before, it comes back full circle, which is nice, to where we started about ekphrasis, and that if you expand if you go back to the original meaning of ekphrasis, it is in fact any art form that responds to any other art form. It's just become much more narrowed. Mm. So now when people say, I do ekphrastic poetry, which is where you'll mostly hear it, they mostly mean write a poem in response to a painting.
Mm.
And so I'm trying to go back and say, it could be a dance in response to a sculpture, and then a sculpture in response to a photograph, and then a song in response to the photograph. You know, I love that idea of pushing that, keeping on going round and round. So something I'd love to do is commission these four poets, four composers, to take one of my poems and do a version, so that you hear, say, these four, I've sort of vaguely teed it up with these four people, who could then take that one poem, and we'd hear it in four different instantiations.
Wow.
And I think that would be really fun. It just sort of keeps the conversation going and moving around. Yeah. I'd love that.
That would be really great. Another of your interests is philosophy, and this interest comes through in many of your poems, particularly the poems about the brain.
Oh, yes.
Which explore the mind-body connection. Luke Fisher, in a review essay of your books, talks about the differences between poetry and philosophy, but he also argues that they share a concern with apprehending the nature of existence.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about your interest in philosophy and poetry and how they intersect, and perhaps if you would like, read one of your brain poems?
Oh, yes. Okay. I would say that they really do intersect for me, though probably in this way, more from a... less overtly, more from some sort of a deep wellspring, I'm trying to think of the right image that you tap into, that I think is in a way just the foundation underneath everything that I do. So I love philosophy, did my PhD in philosophy, talked a lot, taught a lot of philosophy, taught children philosophy, year five and year six for a long time, tutored in philosophy for a long time. So I think it's just present. It comes out in a few little places that you can see more overtly, things like the saying and the said, where I'm talking really about Levinas. I wrote quite a lot about Immanuel Levinas, Jewish philosopher, who was really interested, again, about language and the difference between the saying, the speaking, that to another person, the interpersonal, that way in which you're always presenting words to someone, the other to whom all speech is addressed. That's what he's interested in, rather than that sense of words conveying strict meaning, you know, the written or the sort of the legalistic, the comprehension in that way. So it's splitting up something, which, without going into it at length, is roughly that division, and is something that I was really interested in. And as you say, the mind-body thing. So say in Yawn, which I read yesterday for the people who were here yesterday at my other event, it talks about the way that our bodies... So the other philosopher that I'd be really interested in is Merleau-Ponty. He's a phenomenologist, and he talks a lot about embodied interaction, about, again, the sort of interpersonal, very much on tactility, the capacity that we all have of our bodies to extend our bodily boundaries. It's why we can, you know, catch something or drive a car, and it's why, when we drive a car and we're parking and it's very close, we go like this, as if it's a part of our own body, as if we can sort of suck in that right wheel a little bit. That capacity that we have to hold a hammer and to know exactly where that hammer edge is going to be, that our arm can take it on, that then our sense of ourself extends to that tool. And I think this idea of the phenomenological understanding of the body is something that I'm really interested in. And so, say, with the poem Yawn, I'm saying people, we're more similar through our bodies than we are through our minds. And so a lot of the time when I'm talking about the yawn or, you know, peeing in the middle of the night, sneezing, the fact that we leave hair on the pillow, the fact that we rise on tiptoes in the face of cold water, or, you know, that that we do when we're about to sneeze, that slightly panicked look that everyone gets from it, like this. Those are the things that unite us together as people, more so than, you know, the Weltan Schauung, you know, which is what I refer to in Yawn, more than these ideas of the mental sphere and mutual goals and making decisions based on the meeting of minds. And although in a way you'd think as a philosopher I should be more on that side, I think I'm actually more of the Shylock from Shakespeare, if you cut us, do we not bleed? You know, that idea of the shared humanity based on the physicality of the body is something that really is an underpinning. So I think those are the times when it comes through. And I suppose the other thing with that is about dualism, mind-body dualism. Mm. So as a phenomenologist or someone who likes reading phenomenology, we should be quite against the split between mind and body, that Cartesian split. I know I'm going through this very fast, but I know we don't have much time. Mm. The mind-body split is something we try and heal, but interestingly, it's something that I keep on struggling with. So in a lot of my poems, I have a lot of times when that debate between mind and body comes to the fore. I've dealt with a lot of illness in my life. I've got an autoimmune disease that's made me very ill for about 11 years and was bedridden and in a wheelchair and in hospital for a long time, hence also being able to turn to poetry while I wasn't working during that time. Mm. And so I had a lot of times of the body sort of giving up on one and having this debate between the mind and the body. Yesterday I read Letter to My Brain, so I might just pick a really short one. How are we going on time? We're probably getting close, or are we okay? Maybe I'll pick a different one. I could do Petition to All Brains from The Corporate Body, because it's quite fun. Petition to All Brains from The Corporate Body. We, the undersigned, appeal to you, collective brains. In your sped-up evolution, we propose a dissolution, enact an abolition, offer a supplication for wound-back activity, a renewed proclivity for less tenacity, more conviviality, a meditative ability and a new avidity for forest walks and mountain hikes, less fractious talk causing overproduction of emotional eruption, sleep disruption and mood disturbance, we propose the emergence of a somewhat divergent philosophy of mind and seek to remind that brains should be kind to the body that houses, the spirit that rouses and the will that espouses a raw phenomenology, material biology, non-Cartesian psychology, a hand-in-hand mentality for complementarity, an embodied complicity with more responsibility, responsiveness, repose, a real relationship. We await your response. I suppose that sort of sums up that fight. Yes, we'd love to have a better relationship between the mind and the body, but gee, it's somewhat tricky to do.
Yeah.